I'm Jamie Seeker, and this is What It Takes. Each episode, I sit down with real business owners to talk about their journey, the wins, the challenges, and everything in between. Let's dive in.
Hello, and today on What It Takes, we're thrilled to sit down with someone who's truly redefining what it means to build with intention. Daniel Woodruff is the founder and president of DWG, a landscape architecture studio based in Austin, Texas, and now also in London, that's doing way more than just making things look good. Daniel and his team are creating places that live and breathe, spaces that heal, that connect, and that restore. He's originally from the UK, and his journey took him from studying and practicing in England to leading one of the most forward-thinking landscape architecture firms in the US. His work has turned parking lots into parks. It's transformed toxic brownfields into biodiverse ecosystems and made landscape design feel like both an art and a mission. And we're really excited to unpack the grit, the growth, and the purpose behind his success. So welcome, Daniel, to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Jamie, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So let's just take it back. What first drew you to landscape architecture? Was there like a moment or something you knew that was like this was going to be your path?
Growing up, I always wanted to be a marine biologist. I thought that was my jam. I wanted to go swim with whales. That was it. I always had a passion for architecture as well, but math and I don't necessarily get along. And that was always seen as a barrier that I thought that to do architecture, I had to have, you know, a degree level PhD understanding of mathematics, trigonometry. And so really was focusing more on nature, nature-based solutions. And my mother is a calligrapher and bona fide original hippie. And so nature was always part of my childhood and upbringing. So that's where I gravitated towards marine biology. And then I discovered landscape architecture.
And your work blends ecology, art, and design. So that makes a lot of sense. And I love hearing that, like, your mom came from that kind of art calligraphy background. How do you describe performative landscapes to somebody outside of the industry?
Oh, goodness. That's a really good question. For us, landscape architecture, it's so much more than just plants. Most of our work deals with the built environment, the places that we walk around, the parks, the plazas, the streetscapes, the green roofs. So for us, the performative landscape is about making spaces, making the built environment more human, more enjoyable. And in doing that, not only making things look beautiful, but also truly performative. So it's not about making spaces for a pop-up musician or a performance. Sometimes that is, but it's also about managing stormwater, making environments cooler, thinking about shade and human comfort. And you living in Arizona, me living in Central Texas, shade is a big thing. Human comfort is a big thing. And landscape architecture is really a keen dialogue around how to make landscapes, how to make nature and the environment more performative for humans. So it's, again, that human comfort, but also greater social interactions. And then it's also about economics. It's about making spaces more vibrant, allowing retailers to spill out onto a street and generate more money because they have a great patio or a great park that they can look onto and things like that.
That's wonderful. And Springdale Green is an amazing example of turning damaged site into like a thriving one. Can you walk us through that vision for anybody who doesn't know what that is and kind of like the biggest hurdles that you guys faced in doing that site?
Yeah. So up until the early 1990s, it was a former petrochemical tank farm. It is now classified a brownfield site, meaning that the post-industrial use has finished. It's been cleaned up to a certain level with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. But for us, Springdale Green represented an opportunity to work with an amazing team, amazing client, but to take that brownfield and turn it into an ecological workplace campus, which is a campus by any normal definition, a place for several thousand people to congregate, work, be incredibly creative in a technology world. But to do it in a way to take 30 acres of underperforming and in some cases still dirty and needing to be cleaned up sites, and turning it into a place of ecology and biodiversity and nature that is about making workplace more productive. It's part of being an employee retention tool. It's part of being an uplift to redefining what is it to go to work, and about health and wellness and productivity. And so for us, taking that 30-acre campus, only building on 6 acres of that, and the rest of it being about floodplain and woodland and meadow restoration. It's about beehives and bird boxes, but also a 1 kilometer long elevated boardwalk that you can walk, run, jog, you can go work out in the landscape and truly immerse yourself in an environment that feels very much like a park, but is part of your office. It's really quite remarkable.
That actually is. And you pitch bold, unconventional projects. How do you handle skepticism or pushback? I can imagine you get some in Texas.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I touched on that a few minutes ago in terms of thinking of landscape, not just as an embellishment, not even necessarily as a tool of environmental superiority. But if you think of it as part of an asset management tool, where it is about economics and it's about a return on investment, and thinking that if landscape is a performative element, you can increase productivity, you can increase your sales, you can increase a tenant's willingness to renew their lease and stay longer, you can fill up that office park quicker with a performative, attractive landscape environment. And then, of course, you can actually reduce the bottom line of how much it costs to operate and maintain that campus with green infrastructure, thinking about stormwater, reducing flooding, reducing maintenance costs by using native plants. I mean, for example, Springdale Green has a 650,000-gallon system that collects the stormwater and the condensate off the buildings, which means that there is not a drop of city water used to irrigate 30 acres of landscape. And while water today is still relatively cheap, in time, water scarcity in Central Texas and in Arizona especially is a profound conversation. And water is the new oil in terms of its capacity to really influence wealth and development. And so on a 30-acre campus, to be able to say you don't have to pay that bill anymore is profound. And that's just one tool of dozens that we implemented on Springdale Green to think about how to really think about how we upsell and convince our clients that landscape is an economic tool. It is a return on investment, and it can have profound, profound economic impacts if you retool your thinking from embellishment and beautification to something that is performative and also transformative.
Well, and look at that. You didn't even need, like, you thought math was your barrier, but you're taking these numbers and being like, look at them at the bottom line, and turning that into a numbers game for people to help understand. Because everybody, I don't necessarily know anyone, and I'm sure there are people out here that are just like, no, I hate the environment, I don't really care. You know, I think philosophy-wise, people like the concept of, you know, having good performing, you know, landscape architecture, like all that kind of stuff in theory. But if it's going to cost them, and if it's going to, you know, you have to take the extra mile and it's going to affect the bottom line, it's a lot harder of a sell. So you found a way to do that. And I think it's, you know, I mean, you're wearing both the designer and the business owner hat. How do you protect creativity while still managing a team and running a company? Because you very clearly are thinking about what customers are thinking about and how it affects other people. And as a business owner, you care about the bottom line. We wouldn't have businesses if we didn't look at that, right? We have to be fiscally responsible. But there is an element of very, you know, I can tell, like, your background, your, you know, how you were raised, it's coming from your lineage of just this need to create. And like you said, and all you knew was nature, and you had the hippie and all that kind of stuff. So how do you kind of like balance all of those things and still have a company to run?
Yeah, I think you and I will both agree that there is a fantasy and a spirit of innovation about running a business. I mean, it can be really exciting. It can also be terrifying at the same time. Growing and scaling a business is very different than running a business. And what's the trick? I mean, for me, most certainly, having 27 people more brilliant and more smart than me. You mentioned the math thing. I'm not the one crunching those numbers. The team of experts that are way smarter than me are doing that. And so it's leaning into your greatest asset, which is your team. And knowing that if you build an environment that is stimulating, that is pushing the boundary, that is innovative and inspirational in its philosophies, that you will attract talent. And then how do you retain that talent? About, you know, thinking about, yeah, I mean, the employee's needs. And like any business, I mean, it doesn't matter how creative you want to be, you have to balance it with the pragmatic realities of checks and balances, the sense of invoicing, cash in, cash out. And having a business partner like I do, Eric Schultz, who is, if I'm the chief creative officer, he truly is the chief financial officer, and understanding that left brain, right brain mentality of sharing responsibility and delegation of, we aspire to do X, Y, and Z, but each year we might only be able to do X. And having that excitement to do everything, but a little bit of restraint to know that slow, sustained growth is sometimes better than breakneck vertical growth. And in doing that, we've been able to lean into clients that we trust. We've been able to be a little bit more selective in the work we do. And by being selective, more focused. And I think that has really benefited us in terms of our brand and what our clients expect when they start a conversation with us and then when they get the product at the end of the day.
That's wonderful. You had a couple of key things that stood out to me. One is finding a partner that complements your strengths, knowing what your gaps are and where you need to fill them. I think that's a really, really huge part. A big growth step of being a business owner is recognizing that. And also knowing, you know, like you said, hey, there are people around. I surround myself with people who are really great at what they do too. And so we all can work together. That's really big. But you run a firm across two continents. So one continent, one location even, where you're all in the same place, that's not necessarily an easy task. How do you stay grounded and keep your team aligned about all of those things that you're talking about across cultures? You know, you've got a different, you talk about company culture within our American culture, right? But now we're talking about culture within cultures. You've got a whole other continent out there, a different time zone. How do you, how do you keep that team aligned?
God, that's another great question. We're still figuring it out, very honestly. And I think that's a key message to any innovator and entrepreneur is sometimes there is no playbook. You think there is, but stuff moves all the time. How do we manage it today? We have several advantages, and we're very much leaning into that. One, the senior partner in London is a gentleman that I've known for close to 35 years. So trust is 9/10 of the rule of law. We went to school together. We went to Louisiana State University together. We've traveled the world together. Our kids have grown up together. There is this sense of telepathy. Of kind of the unspoken word of, we have common goals. So finding that right person was huge. We've aspired to have an office in London for, 14 of the 15 years of the firm. But the longer I've stayed here in Austin, the harder it is to plug back into London and recapture those relationships, understanding taxation and law and blah, 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 blah. So to have someone landed, grounded there, who lives there, who's worked there for 25 years or more, and just keep doing what they're doing was massive. To then embrace that his senior design director is based in Valencia in Spain, and that Marin and Maureen make up the core partnership of the London office, London and Valencia, and how we're then simply just operating on a new global platform of Zoom and communication and using technology to our advantage. I travel a lot. It's still exciting for now. But it's not just to London. I mean, we have clients in the Middle East. We have clients in New York, in California, Pennsylvania. It's inherently a part of what we do. But I think at the end of the day, time zones, I say it's only 6 hours difference. It's still a big difference, but it does actually allow us to be highly productive here and then flick the switch and kind of they can be highly productive there. They're also working on different projects. We've done much more private sector work here and are leaning into public sector more and more and more. In London, they're doing almost all public sector work and wanting to do more private sector work. So in time, those paths will meet and actually kind of cross and overlap, and we'll share our resources more and more and more. But yeah, I really, Jamie, I think trust and transparency of communication and leaning in and a little bit of extra effort, not pushing those calendar schedules and simply just committing to that 8 a.m. call and knowing that it's 3 p.m. there, and that's okay, you know, and just kind of making it work and adjusting your mindset. And we have staff who used to work here in the States that are now back in India. That's 11 hours difference. I mean, there are times when Shamaka is on staffing calls and it's 10 o'clock at night for her. That changes the dynamic significantly. But right now, Austin, London is really pretty good. It's very good, actually. Great. It's fun.
And that's wonderful. But I bet looking back, it wasn't all rainbows and sunshine. And is there a moment that you felt like maybe you hit a wall or even considered walking away?
From a project or landscape architecture in life?
However you interpret that question, I think those are both equally...
The onset of and the formation of DWG in 2010 was certainly an inflection point. We were all dealing with the downturn in the economy and through 2008, 2009. Many of my friends had been let go. The available work was little to nothing. And I was given an option and I gave myself an option. Stay at the firm I was at and sacrifice happiness and just deal with it, or take a leap of faith and do something for me, something that redefines those kind of boundaries. And that was there were some people, Jamie, that said, Daniel, you're an idiot. What are you doing? Like, you've got a job, just deal with it. Like, you're taking a check at home every month, and work is work. Make your life what it needs to be. And I actually said, no, I think now is the right time to take that leap of faith. And that could have been the biggest mistake. That could have been a career shattering move. But it actually turned into a moment of profound transformation. And nobody really had any work back then. And there were many clients that reached out and said, we're going to rub sticks together. We're going to find little things to keep ourselves busy, but we're going to help each other. And that has been truly inspirational for the last 15 years. And just last week, we celebrated our 15th anniversary. And to go through that amount of time that quickly, to have some clients that we still work with today, and we've built upon that, and to know that we've stumbled, we've learned a lot. It's horrible when a project goes away or you mess up or, you know, you do something, but you learn from those mistakes. But thankfully, knock on wood, we've never been sued. We've never been in a lawsuit. We've always strove, and we do have clients that have come back to us time and time again. But I think one of the biggest lessons of being a business owner is that it's not always roses and green pastures. And you do have to sometimes know a good CPA. Sometimes you need to know a good lawyer. And having that fellowship and collaboration beyond just your own discipline is also another really critical piece that helps you avoid those gut-wrenching, horrible moments that thankfully we've had very few of.
Well, congratulations on the 15 years. I know you're not the math numbers guy, but you're breaking, like, shattering statistics all around by being around that long. And I don't know if you know any of them, but the statistics of making it through your first entire full year as a small business owner is very, very slim. And I don't know the number off the top of my head, and I don't think you really care anyways. But and then to make it to 10 years is like a smaller percentage of that small percent. And for you to hit move beyond past that to 15 is really saying a lot. And I think it was how you started off answering that question came to the what it takes moment for me is I'm hearing from a lot of business owners when they were faced with staying in their comfort zone and pushing beyond that and taking that leap of faith. That is a character trait that I'm seeing is that unwavering, like I know that this is my path and I'm gonna keep moving forward, even if it doesn't look right to everybody else, even if it doesn't, you know, I'm not gonna sacrifice, you know, whatever for you, it was your happiness or, you know, it sounds like things were going on there that you needed to just kind of move beyond. And I want to put that question to you in your experience. What do you think it really takes to be a business owner? What have you learned that no one told you from the start?
First and foremost, I mean, you have to have a dream. You have to have a vision. I don't believe you need the most watertight business plan. That can come with time. And there are tools and tricks and technologies that can help you get there really quickly today. While you've got to believe in yourself, you've got to truly believe that you are the front man, the back man, and the middle man when you get started. You also have to have a gaggle, an entire nest of relationships. You have to understand that delegation and outsourcing is your friend. Even though you want to hold on to everything dearly and tightly on day one, you also have to learn the painful reality that sometimes you have to spend money to make money and you have to invest in yourself, and that money is never going to grow on trees and you truly have to work for it. And I think there's that spirit of entrepreneurship and knowing that you are a technological startup and you need people to invest in you physically, materially, and financially. And to do that, you have to be charismatic and charming. You have to be able to talk and speak passionately about what you bring to the table. And I think if you do all of those passionately, it doesn't have to be expertly or with the greatest eloquency. It's just speaking from your heart, people will believe you. And I think if you try and dilute that, if you try and pitch something that you don't passionately believe in, it can feel very transparent and people can pick up on that very quickly. And so, yeah, I think really believing that yes, you can, but also yes, and are really kind of critical moments of being a young business owner. And even today, 15 years in, I still consider myself like every day is a freaking learning experience. And there are curveballs all the time, and knowing that you have to be nimble and duck quickly sometimes and run fast at other times. That's just the world we live in. That's not about necessarily being a small business owner. That's just life. But it is very true of a small business owner.
And that's great perspective. Passion, doing something with passion is better than doing something with an expertise. And knowing that learning is a big part of that journey is that you have to continue to learn. And if you've got what it takes, the passion will take you there too. So Daniel, thank you so much for reminding us that beauty in business isn't just about what people see. It's about the intention behind it. And whether it's transforming a neglected urban corner or advocating for nature in our cities, Daniel, your story shows that purpose and perseverance can absolutely go hand in hand. If you want to see more of what DWG is up to, where can listeners find you?
Yeah, I mean, we try and keep our website as dynamic as possible. There's always lots of news and project updates there. That's studiodwg.com. And then Instagram is always fun and visual. And that's at studiodwg. So, and you can find links to our variety of other platforms and YouTube and everything else there. So, and again, Jamie, thank you so much.
Oh, I love this conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show. If you guys love this conversation and this episode, please share it with someone who cares about great design, great leadership, great cities. Don't forget to follow us for more conversations like this on What It Takes.
This podcast is brought to you by Seeker Solution, Are you a business owner feeling overwhelmed? We can help. Head over to seekersolution.com to schedule a call today. Would you or someone you know like to be featured on this podcast? Our applications are now open. Apply today at seekersolution.com and click on the podcast link to get started.